Attention, listeners. Do you ever find yourself struggling to decide what to watch on a Saturday night when you're in the mood for horror? Or perhaps you're trying to round out your own horror film education. In either case, I'm sure you'll be able to make some great discoveries in my 10x10 horror watch list, featuring a breakdown of the 10 favorite horror movies from 10 renowned horror directors. We did a deep dive of the favorite horror movies from directors including Guillermo del Toro, Ari Aster, Jordan Peele, Quentin Tarantino, James Gunn, Rob Zombie, Martin Scorsese, and many more. Here you'll find a collection of each director's favorite horror movies, along with quotes about what they appreciated about the films, all in an easy-to-reference PDF that you can download absolutely free. Featuring a mix of well-worn classics and deep cuts, hopefully you'll discover some overlooked gems and look at old classics through new lenses. Download the 10x10 horror watch list for free by visiting nicktaylor.com/horrorguide. That's nicktaylor.com/horrorguide. Welcome to the Nick Taylor Horror Show. As always, each episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show explores how today's horror filmmakers are getting their movies made while deconstructing their methods and career strategies into practical insights that you can use on your own horror filmmaking journey. Francis Galluppi is the director of The Last Stop in Yuma County, a southern-fried, hard-boiled crime thriller that plays within the traditions of Tarantino, the Coen brothers, Taylor Sheridan, and Elmore Leonard, while still establishing a feel and style all of its own. I loved this movie. It's a fun, lean, and mean piece of cinema, bolstered by an incredible ensemble cast, including Richard Brake, Jim Cummings, Jocelyn Donahue, Barbara Crampton, and many more. The Last Stop in Yuma County is Francis's feature debut, and the film caught the eye of Sam Raimi and ultimately led to Francis being handed the reins of an upcoming Evil Dead movie. This is really awesome. Prior to Last Stop in Yuma County, Francis's short film High Desert Hell won several awards, including the Wes Craven Award at the Catalina Film Festival in 2019, and his follow-up, The Gemini Project, won Best Science Fiction Fantasy Short at the Burbank International Festival in 2020. In this conversation, Francis and I get into the grueling story behind the making of Last Stop in Yuma County, which was a four-plus year labor of love involving blood, sweat, tears, and mortgage. Houses. This is an excellent account of true indie filmmaking, the importance of preparation, working with an all-star cast, and never, ever giving up. I owe a big thank you to my friend David Guglielmo for putting me in touch with Francis and making this interview happen. Thank you, David. Now, please enjoy this conversation with Francis Galluppi. Francis Galluppi, good to see you, man. How's it going?
Good to see you, man. It's going good.
Good.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Now, please, thanks for being here. Yeah. Enjoy the hell out of Yuma. Just really fun, lean, mean, just angry piece of cinema. I enjoyed the hell out of it. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you, dude.
How does it feel to have that in the can?
God, it's incredible. I've spent 4.5 years of my life on this thing. I've had 2 kids in the time it took me to make this movie. So, yeah, I mean, it's just nice to see it out in the world finally. And honestly, getting the good reception it's gotten, there were so many things that were not expected at all that happened. So it's just been a really fucking cool experience, man.
That's great. Nice. I know there's a pretty big epic story behind getting it made. So would love to... Yes. Where should we start? Should we start with your early career and everything that led up to this?
Yeah, man. Cool. I can just go on a rant and stop me if you want me to elaborate on certain things. But yeah, so my background is music. I started playing in punk bands with my older brothers when I was fucking 11 years old, playing gnarly backyard parties in East LA, and did that whole thing. Graduated high school, bought a van, toured, and went to college for music. And that was pretty much my whole life, man. It was just hopping from band to band and hitting the road. And then when I was 28, I broke my wrist. And I couldn't play drums for 6 months. And so I picked up a T2i, the fucking Canon T2i, had a $100, 50 mil on there. And I shot a short film around the house with my wife and I. It was just, there was no crew or anything. It took us like months because there was no script. We were just like figuring it out as we went. And yeah, I just fell in love. I was always more obsessed with movies, or like more interested in movies than I was with music. Yep. I was always the guy in the back of the van watching Hitchcock and studying film, but never just, it always seemed like impossible to, or unobtainable, right? Like you grow up watching Back to the Future and Star Wars and shit, and you're just like, I have no idea how any of this gets made. And then you see something like The Evil Dead or like Funny Games, and like it's so simple, and you could tell they just went out there and just had a fucking blast and just did it. And so after I did that short film with my wife and I around the house, I was like, I started writing, or I wrote a script based on a location that I had free access to. So my buddy had a desert house out by the Salton Sea, sort of did this like Texas Chainsaw ripoff, and got all my friends together, bandmates, friends, and just, we went out to the desert. We had no fucking clue what we were doing, but we just learned everything on YouTube. I learned how to color and do sound design and score and VFX and all that stuff. So we were able to make short films for like little to no money. But I wasn't writing anything like where it was like we needed a budget for location. So like the next one I did, my buddy had a cabin out in Oregon, and I had a tour van, so I just packed it with all my buddies and went to Oregon and shot this weird black and white like clone story out there. And again, got to learn a lot about VFX. It was all one actor playing three different roles. And yeah, and so I was just self-taught, didn't go to film school. And my first short film, High Desert Hell, the Texas Chainsaw one I was telling you about, that played at a film festival in Cincinnati. And God, at the time I was so fucking broke, and I just had a feeling I should fly out there. So I flew out there, and it was terrible screening. It was like 7 a.m. the morning after the opening night party. Nobody was there, but this dude, James, showed up, and he saw it and was basically like, let's make a movie. I'll give you $50,000 for whatever you do next, or it was something like that. And so I was like, for me, that was insane, right? I was like, that I could make multiple features with $50,000. So I started, I just did what I did with the short films. I found a location out in Palmdale, wrote a script specifically to that location, went there, drew overheads of the layout, and just wrote it for that location. And then I started like producing it. I was like, I'm going to make this thing. I think at the time it was like $100,000 was the budget we had in mind. Mm-hmm. And then James had a loose connection with Richard Brake. So we got the script to Rich, and then he called me and was like, I want to do this. And I was like, holy shit. Okay. Maybe we can make this thing it could go bigger. So I didn't know anybody any better at the time. And I ended up optioning the script to a company that was like, we're going to make this for $5 million.
Whoa.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, where do I sign? And very quickly realized that it was just the name game. It was, we need to get fucking like Jean-Claude Van Damme or Bruce Willis or a name like that with the foreign market value. And it just wasn't the movie that I wanted to make. And also, even when we agreed on names that could work, everyone was saying no. Like, I was a first time filmmaker. We were just sending an offer. I was never like had an opportunity to get in the room and talk to them. It was a lot of gatekeeping. It was just like, you shut up and stand over there and let us like find the money. So as soon as the option expired, I pulled it, and I was like, I would rather make the $100,000 version of this movie than do it this way.
Yeah.
So I guess I just started like pretending like we had money. Like I started like just like prepping extensively, using shot designer and planning every shot and going out there to the location and photo boarding and like picking out HODs and then writing letters to the cast, like personalized letters, and start to build the cast up with David.
Handwritten letters that went in the mail.
No, they were just, I would write them and then we would email them.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, yeah. But God, that would be cool too. In a sec, I'll grab that book with some of the prep work I was telling you about. But yeah, so basically anything I could do without money, I was doing. I was just like pretending like we're making the movie. And finally, God, we just kept getting so lucky with the cast. Like once it was like we had six, I always wanted to work with these indie darlings. Like I literally wrote the script with Jocelyn Donahue in mind. I had Jim in mind for the longest time. I wrote it with Rich in mind. I saw Sierra McCormick in The Vast Tonight and was like, immediately, that's Sybil. I saw fucking Nicholas Logan and I Care a Lot and that's Travis. So that was like my dream cast, and we got it. We just kept, and we kind of kept pushing our luck. Once it was like halfway casted with these cool indie darlings that I really loved, it was like, what if we got Barbara Crampton to play the receptionist? And we just kept pushing our luck and got really lucky. And then James, he'd been messing around with me for a long time. Yo, I'm just going to sell my house to finance this thing. And I was like, don't do that, dude. We'll figure it out. And then I don't think we would have figured it out. Nobody wanted to make this movie, even with this cast. It was just like, it's a period piece. It's this and that. It's just, you know, it's not in the fucking Hollywood mandate or whatever the fuck. Right. So I called James one morning. I was like, yo, I don't know if you're messing around with me or not, but if you are serious, this is what it looks like. We have full creative control and we can make the movie that's on the page. And he sold his house and we were up and running like maybe a month, 2 months tops later. And yeah, and it was a fucking incredible experience. Like, it was really like summer camp every day. Like, we all were there for the right reasons. Nobody was there for a paycheck. It was like the right way to make an indie movie. But yeah, and I always tell that story just because, like, I don't think, like, I wouldn't advise filmmakers to go find somebody that's going to sell their house to finance right. a movie. But it's really just about, it's not, there's not just one way to make a movie or to finance a movie, right? You don't have to cast the fucking, the person with quote unquote value to get things financed. Like, mm-hmm. I talk to a lot of filmmakers that are just like, I'm going to wait till the thing gets like greenlit before I start doing all this planning and prep work. And I'm like, that stuff doesn't, like, obviously time is money, but like, that stuff isn't costing money. You should be prepping as much as you can, because it's just going to make it that much of an easier sell when you're talking to that person with money to be like, look at what I've done. Mm. Like, the movie is ready to fucking go. Just tell me when. So yeah, there's just not one way to make a movie. Like, it's a miracle that any movie gets made, and there's a million different ways to get a movie made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. The thing about the cast, it felt so handpicked, and it felt like everybody was so committed, and the cast was wonderful. Shout out to David Guglielmo, who your casting guy. But
Yeah, like I said, everybody, like, so I would jump on Zooms with everybody, and most of the time we didn't even talk about the script. It was just like, nobody auditioned for this movie. It was just, look, I saw you in this movie. It's fucking, you're wonderful. I think you can do anything. And then we just talked about movies. Like, the first time I met Jim, I wrote him a letter. He invited me to his house. I was a massive fan of Jim
before. I had him on the show a couple years ago.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah, he's fucking, it's just, his whole independent ethos on filmmaking has always been the North Star for me. I actually didn't even really consider Jim in the beginning, because I was just like, oh, he's only going to act in movies he directs. Like, I think he'd be perfect for this, but like, he's never. And then my buddy Scott was listening to him on a podcast. It might have been the Empire podcast. And he was like, yeah, I really want to work or like act for other filmmakers, but nobody ever hits me up.
Oh, wow.
And so Scott was like, Jim said he wants to work. So, after that, I like wrote the letter. He invited me over. We had coffee and like, we just talked about South Park for hours.
Whoa.
We didn't even talk about the fucking movie. And I think, too, a lot of people, when they read the script, they weren't sure if it was like a dark comedy. Mm-hmm. But Jim has told me recently, as soon as like you sat down and we talked about South Park, I was like, oh, I get this guy's. He's going to find the humor and things. And which, that was always the case. This movie is so fucking absurd, right? It just keeps getting more and more. My buddy Gabe and I, the sound guy on Last Stop, we kept referring to it as, it's a clown car, right? It just keeps people just keep getting piled in. And
But tonally, it's taken very seriously. And I think that allows the humor to bubble. Like, I feel like nobody's laboring over being funny, including you as the director, but that'll
present
itself.
No, we're not going for jokes. No, exactly. We're just putting these like kind of absurd characters in this serious situation, and we're seeing how they can navigate through it.
Yeah.
Which is always, that's more funny to me. You know what I mean? Is, I don't know, watching these idiots trying to figure out what to do next is really fun to me. Yeah.
So with a movie like this, it has a very specific tone. And I think with your cast, everybody felt like they were very much tonally on the same page. The same universe, the same movie.
Yep.
With these kind of hard-boiled films, there's a real sensibility and sense of world building. So I'm curious, with it, such a dynamic cast, how did you get everybody on the same sort of tonal wavelength so everybody was operating within the same universe?
Just talking. A lot of conversations. We would jump on. I would jump on Zooms like one-on-one. Mm-hmm. With every single actor, we would comb through the script, and anything that felt contrived or didn't feel right, like, we'd have a conversation about it, and I would rewrite it on the spot.
Well,
so there was no, like, there was never a moment where an actor showed up on set and was like, I don't think I would say that. It was like, no, we already talked about this. And here, let me grab this book real quick. It's right here. Hold on.
Oh, cool.
So I was also able to share with all the actors, like, all the prep work, which helped them a lot, like, to show them the blocking, which I can show you right now. But, like, here's like, some of the... Oh, I don't know if you can see it because my screen's cut off.
Let me see.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can see it. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a whole book of all the fucking prep work. Like, oh, it basically shows... It. We use this... So, basically, what we do is we use SketchUp and we design the building, and then we take that and we flatten it out, and then we put it into a program called Shot Designer, and then we plan every shot as an overhead where the camera is in relation to the subject. Mm-hmm. And then we can even place lighting in there and stuff. So it was really like, it feels like a team when you're like in the morning we'd like huddle and we'd look at this overhead and be like, this is what's going on.
Like
this
football diagrams.
Totally. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. So, aside from just like tonally knowing, being on the same page by having those conversations and being really open to talking about wardrobe, and like Sierra was so involved in that. She put together like this mood board, and every actor works differently, but you want to lean into every different side of it. The technicality of things, like, that we were also very much on the same page because I had all this stuff planned out. So it was like, again, there was never really a moment where it was like, I don't think I'd stand over there. I don't think I'd sit over there, because we're all looking at it and we're talking about it.
And you had done that over Zoom for weeks, if not months prior. Yeah,
exactly. And I was showing them the diagrams. Like, I was sharing my screen and showing the diagrams.
So you planned the blocking out before anybody even set foot on set. Like, way, way ahead of time.
Way before. Yeah, I even planned all the VFX shots. Like, I was like, the camera's going to be over here. This is where we're going to hide the tube. This is where we're going to do this. So it was never like telling special effects dude, I don't know, man, figure it out. It was very much, no, this is where we're going to hide things. This is how we're going to do it.
And you were doing that with your DP?
Yeah. So my DP and I, Mac, we like have done he's shot everything I've ever done. He's done my 2 short films, 4 music videos, the feature, and then everything after this. And yeah, he's just, I don't think I'll ever find anybody that's going to, like Jim always says this, nobody cares. Nobody is ever going to care as much as you care. And it's true. There is 100% truth to that. And you have to act that way. Like, you always have to act that way. You just have to accept the fact that nobody is going to care more than you, and people are going to a lot of the times give it 75%, and then you have to push them to do the extra 25%. And Mac is not that way. He's always been very much very committed. I have my hands full right now working on a bunch of different things, and he is just, he's there with me every step of the way.
That's
and
amazing.
I don't think I could do it without him. So shout out to Mac Fiskin. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, everyone needs to find their Mac.
So with such a dynamic cast, a lot of which are obviously indie darlings, have done a lot of movies, and you, this being your first feature, what was your, how did you prepare to work with actors of this magnitude? Because obviously, like you said, different actors work in different ways, and this was such an ensemble of characters and actors that you had. What was your preparation like as a first-time feature director in getting prepared to work with actors?
Again, it was just a lot of conversations, a lot of this, you know, plan. The thing is, like, somebody asked me that. They were like, oh, were you nervous to work with so-and-so? Because I know you're such a big fan. When you're up against the clock and you're this prepared, you don't have time to be nervous. You just show up and you're like, we got to fucking go. Stick to the game plan. Obviously, like, things fall apart. It's inevitable. Like, especially even in a big production, like for like in Last Stop, the cars never worked. And so we always had to pivot, or like there would be a massive like rainstorm outside and it's supposed to be fucking hot. And problems happen, and it's your job as a director to figure out how to pivot. But the more prepared you are, the easier it is and the quicker you're going to find that alternate route. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't care if it was Brad Pitt on set. I just don't, there's no time to be like nervous. Mm-hmm. It's just like you have a job and you've got to go. And in hindsight, I'm like, oh yeah, I should have been really nervous. I was working with some of my favorite actors ever, like Rich and Barbara and Alex. But yeah, you show up and you're like, you have one job and you got to get it done. But yeah, so that's how I dealt with it, just by being extremely prepared on both. And also, like, I write character bios and I send everybody bios. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there was never a point where somebody asked me a question about a character or something and I was like, huh, I don't know. It's no, I made these characters up.
Yeah.
I should have an answer, right? At the end of the day, that's all we're doing is we're just like, we're not curing cancer. We're just making shit up. But when you're writing these characters, I think it's important to really give these characters a backstory and really like they're three-dimensional characters. And three-dimensional, is that right?
I think so.
Is that the right word?
Yeah, three-dimensional.
Somebody's gonna be, yeah.
I think fourth-dimensional means that they're like in multi-dimensions.
Yeah, maybe Travis is a fourth-dimensional character. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, so that's how I handle it, is just being like overly prepared.
Yeah. This world building and with doing all the backstory, I'm wondering, this is such a solid fleshed out world. I feel like you have your own Elmore Leonard universe. Are you thinking of doing any other films that would take place in this universe, whether sequels or just adjacent stories or anything like that?
No, I don't think so. Maybe, or I have one that I wrote that's just, it's like Last Stop, but on crack. It's like even more wild. But yeah, I don't know, man. I'm not really, I want to do all sorts of different genres.
Yeah.
I want to make a sci-fi. I want to make a horror movie. I definitely don't want to get pigeonholed into a certain thing. I just love movies. And I think at the end of the day, if the characters are compelling and worth exploring and it's a good story, then I want to do it.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm like targeting a specific corner of a genre. I have a family and like I have kids, and I think that whatever it is I do, I need to be extremely passionate about it, because I'm spending the next few years of my life fully dedicating myself to that one thing. So if I don't absolutely love it, then it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
As far as budget, it was a fairly low budget. But you can't tell by looking at it. Production value is fantastic. The budget I read it was somewhere sub 1 million.
Sub million. Yeah. Yeah.
But what were some of the things you did to maximize production value? Because you don't really, this doesn't feel low budget. It doesn't have that sort of, all right, we have to forgive it because, you know, there's no suspension of anything. So what were some of the strategies for ensuring production value at that level?
Again, I think just the prep work with like, planning out the shots, being that prepared gives like your DP more time to make things look pretty.
Yeah.
When you're like, you're not sitting there and be like, I don't know, how should we cover this scene? It's no, we know how we're covering this fucking scene. And we've already thought about how it looks. And like what we did too, is because this is such an overused location, we went and we were fortunate enough to like, because a lot of other movies and TV shows have shot here, we went and found like everything that is ever shot in this diner. And we watched it and we were like, we don't like this. We don't like this. This is cool. And we had a long conversations about, we use Shot Deck. And I don't know if you're familiar with Shot Deck, but it's basically a website where you can create decks. And then there's high resolution screen grabs from like pretty much every movie. And you
can
build a deck. And so we were looking at lighting and we're like, okay, we like the sort of like this look and that look. And we have long conversations about what everything looks like, so you can move quickly. And so, yeah, obviously like things looking really pretty helps. Wardrobe, obviously. I had Alabama Blonde, our costume designer, who's fucking incredible. Charlie Texter, my production designer, who's fucking incredible. Zach is fucking incredible. Jake, who had his hands full in this thing. He did hair, makeup, and special effects.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because we were very short staffed. Like, we didn't have money to have a massive crew. But yeah, it was just like, but taking the time to really talk about these things and like figuring out a cohesive tone. And then obviously we blow up a fucking truck, so that helps.
Yeah, you had an honest to goodness explosion. Yeah. I was really happy to see. I could tell by looking at it, that's not CG. You blew a car the fuck.
It's so funny, man. I get so many people like, how did you blow up the truck? Is that CG? And I'm like, are you fucking kidding? No, it's not CG.
Yeah, they're, really not.
Yeah. So that was like, that was a hill that I was going to die on, was making sure everything was practical. No. Even the Rifleman episode playing on the TV, I was like, we are not doing that in post. We are getting the fucking rights. We're getting that footage, and we're going to play it on the motherfucking TV. like, it was very much like, I wanted to use squibs. I wanted to use blanks. That was the one hill that I was going to die on. With that said, though, there are about 90 VFX shots in the movie that are, you can't even fucking tell. And it's never adding. It's all, there's a massive warehouse outside of that diner that we had to remove in every exterior shot. It was a fucking nightmare. Yeah. My buddy Chris Mapes did all the VFX with that, and he looks perfect. Yeah. And he doesn't even have a VFX background. He's just my friend. And I was like, hey, do you want to, I'll make you an associate producer if you come and do this. And he's really smart and he figured it out. Yeah, I would say, because, man, CG fucking bullet hits do not look good, and they would just cheapen the thing. No. So I would say if you have the money, try and put it towards making the effects practical, because it looks so much better.
It's such a difference. Yeah. And I think it goes beyond, like, special effects and, like, blood effects and creature effects. It's like explosions. If you see two cars, honest to goodness, crashing together, you feel that somatically, kinetically. Yeah. You can tell that's real. Like watching the explosions. Holy shit, they blew up a real car there.
Yeah, and even from the opening shot of this movie, it was like, if we open up with a live animal.
Yeah.
All of that a sudden, wasn't like, seen? Fuck no, dude.
Oh, wow, that bird just landed and did that and just perfectly cinematically.
Well, it was all planned.
Was it? The bird wasn't trained, though.
Was it trained. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? So, you can train little finches like that?
Yeah. So it was basically what I did is I got this little like finger puppet on Amazon of a bird, and then we went and I shot that scene. I was like, so the bird is here, the car pulls up, the door opens, the bird's supposed to fly this way. And I sent it to the bird wrangler. I was like, can you do this? And he was like, yeah, give me 2 weeks. And the bird showed up and fucking nailed it first take. I think we did 4 takes.
No.
And it actually is a lot longer than what it is in the movie. That bird actually, because in the movie it's 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. In real time, it's about 4 minutes because the opening shot, it took so long for that car to get down that road.
Okay.
That, like, I was like, man, people are going to fucking be so bored if they're watching this bird for 4 minutes. So what I did is I did a split screen. I did a speed ramp for the car coming down.
Okay.
The road. So, and then I like smoothed out the speed ramp when he gets like to the halfway point. But yeah, that's all real, man. That was always the sort of bookend to the movie, was opening up with the shot and ending, or opening up with the bird and ending with the bird.
Yeah. I was looking at it and I was like, this does not look CGI at all, but trained that type of bird to do that.
Yeah. It's a parakeet.
Okay.
Or wait, is it a parakeet? No. Canary.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a canary. That's what it is. Yeah. But it totally looks like a desert bird. He was sending me all these pictures. And I was like, yeah, like that one looks like it would be in the desert. Yeah. But yeah, no, there was no like happy accidents like that. It was all prepped. But yeah, that's funny. You thought it was CG. Yeah, it's all real. It's a real bird.
Yeah. No, it looks awesome. Those little touches, man, they go so far in just not doing things.
Yeah, CGI. Totally, dude. Yeah. It's easily, again, it goes back to nobody is going to care more than you. Yeah. So if I brought that to the team, I was like, I really want a bird, to my producers, figure it out. They'd be like, okay, just do a CG bird. We're not going to fucking pay it. You know what I mean? Like, any producer would say that.
Yeah.
Just do a CG bird. And so it's really up to you to be like, no, I want the bird to be practical. I'm going to reach out to a bird wrangler. I'm going to figure this out.
And that ethic of filmmaking just permeates throughout the whole movie. It feels very handcrafted. That's real. That's the real job. The real cinema is busting your ass to get that one little detail that any producer would be like, why the fuck you need a real bird? You know why you need it. Yes. And the audience sees it and understands why. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly, man. Yeah.
That's awesome. Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know you're very tight-lipped about the subject, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your most recent opportunity. I think you are. We have a lot of horror filmmakers listening, so I feel like you are the subject of a lot of envy. But let me just say up front, I'm so happy for you.
Oh, cool.
I know we just met, but dude, I'm so happy for you.
Yeah. It's. I mentioned it earlier, and I'm not bullshitting when I say it's like the movie that made me want to make movies, or at least it's the movie that like inspired me to go out to the middle of nowhere with my friends and make something. There's like the Evil Dead. There's just an energy in that film where you can just tell Bruce and Sam went out there and just fucking had a blast, and they just did it. And it was so inspiring. Yeah, I'm a massive fan of all of them. So it's wild.
Yeah.
It's really wild.
What I love is that they are opening the franchise up to newer filmmakers. Like, they could have just given that to someone who's got six movies under their belt or whatever. But with you and Sebastian, they really feel like they are attempting to really like launch careers into the stratosphere with something like Evil Dead. And observing Fede Alvarez before that, who had never done a feature before. I just love that they are passing the torch forward in a really nice way and helping relative newcomers enter this franchise, which I think just the ethic of that, I just love. It warmed my heart, to be honest.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah, they really care. Oh. They really care about making a good movie, which is so refreshing, because I had no idea before I met Sam and Rob and Bruce and Jose and Rommel and all those guys, but they care so much about the franchise, and it's really a collaborative effort. It's really fucking exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you at liberty to talk about, obviously not what you pitched, but how the opportunity came about, how you were able to be in front of Sam Raimi?
He just saw Last Stop.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah.
So. Super cool.
He saw the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, but enough.
Yeah. It's been wild. Yeah, I wish I could talk about it more, but definitely we'll have to come back on the show.
Please, please.
Once the movie's out and we can rap about it. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Cool, man. I know we're wrapping up, but having your first feature in the can, I'm curious. Looking back, obviously there's so many decisions to be made on any movie. What would you have invested more in, and what would you have invested less in if you could do it all over again? I don't necessarily mean money. It could be time, energy, resources. But what did you underplay that would have mattered more, and what did you overspend on?
There's the first thing that comes to my mind is, like, I was just doing a commentary with Mac, and we were talking about all the prep work, and I remember like being really specific about things that didn't matter at all. I remember I was so worried about the fucking coffee pots, and I was like, okay. And I like literally drew a map or a guide to where the coffee should be at every point in the story in the pot. Like, it was like, so when Robert and Erlene come in, like, he has coffee, she doesn't, so it should be down here, and then blah, 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 and then that one's out, and so we have to move to the second one. I was so worried about having the three-banger coffee station going on, and, like, where the coffee was. Okay, and then when she comes in, it was so meticulously planned, and we watch the movie now, and you're like, nobody gives a fuck. Like, yeah. I don't even give a fuck. Like, I completely lost sight of that during the edit, and I was like, oh, yeah. I remember I was so worried, even on set, I was like, wait, is that right? Let me look at the guy. Like, that shit doesn't matter, dude. So I'm a freak about continuity, and it doesn't fucking matter. Some of it matters. I guess it's this. I don't regret spending time on that, because the one thing it does is, if you are that detailed over something so stupid, it just tells your HODs, like, okay, this motherfucker is a psychopath and I need to be on my A game. So I guess it helps in some capacity.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool, man. This was a real pleasure. So thank you so much, man, for being here. This was
so
great
talking to you, man. Thank you. And I promise I'll come back.
Great. Great. No, I can't.
If you'll have me.
Please. Yeah, absolutely. So cool, before any parting wisdom for those aspiring filmmakers out there, before we
close. Set a fucking date, set a hard deadline, and just go out and make it. Don't wait till you have an Alexa Mini and these specific lenses, and you have a phone, you have your friends, go out and make something and learn how to do it yourself. Don't wait till you have enough money to find an editor. You should always be editing your own stuff. If you're not, I think you're depriving yourself of a very educational thing of just like having to sit and watch all your mistakes over and over again and being like, I spent too much time on this and too little time on that, and I think it's really important. So go out and shoot it.
Awesome.
Make stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
This was great, man. Thanks again.
Cool. Thank you, man.
All right. Here, as always, are some key takeaways from this conversation with Francis Galluppi. Number one, prepare extensively. Preparation was crucial to Francis's process, and his level of prep was extensive and very impressive. Every shot was meticulously storyboarded and diagrammed with blocking details. All of this was done months before production began. Ultimately, this prep enabled him to achieve complex and high production value work on a relatively low budget. Francis also engaged in extensive conversations with the actors, fully fleshing out the script and characters and every line of dialogue over Zoom. By the time everyone arrived on set, the team was well prepared to hit their marks, which is critical on a lower budget. Francis's process demonstrates that there is no such thing as over-preparing. All of this ensured a fairly smooth production and Francis's ability to pivot whenever things went wrong. Number two. Set a deadline and make it happen. Francis stresses the importance of setting a hard deadline with your projects and committing to them. Waiting for perfect conditions or resources can delay or prevent the realization of a project. He emphasizes the importance of prepping before you're greenlit, which may sound counterintuitive to filmmakers who are hesitant to invest time in a project that may or may not happen. However, extensive preparation increases the likelihood of your film coming to fruition. Preparation at this level not only creates a sense of reality and momentum for your project, but also impresses producers and investors, making your project appear more tangible and ready to go, all of which is attractive because it makes your project a lot easier to greenlight. Number three, edit your own work. Francis quickly mentioned that early on, directors should edit their own films because doing so is a valuable learning experience. It forces you to confront your mistakes and understand what works and what doesn't about your shooting style and directorial capacity. Being able to objectively observe your work at this level will ultimately make you a much better filmmaker. Anyway, guys, thanks as always for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with your friends and family on social media? Don't forget to follow the show at Nick Taylor Horror Show. That's Nick Taylor Horror Show on TikTok and Instagram. Thanks again for listening to the Nick Taylor Horror Show. We scare because we care. Hey, guys, one last thing before you head off, and this is The Howl. How would you like a monthly newsletter featuring a recap of the latest horror news, my personal movie recommendations, updates from the show, and cool stuff I've recently discovered in the world of horror? If that sounds like something you'd enjoy, sign up for my monthly email newsletter, The Howl. You can join by visiting nicktaylor.com/thehowl today.